to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. I'd like to talk this morning a little about what I see as a kind of paradox of Zen practice that generally I think most people come to Zen practice out of some dissatisfaction with their own lives and some feeling of wanting to be better, or we have this concept of self-improvement or always bettering yourself. And actually that's not actually what Zen practice is about. The basics as I understand it of Zen practice is that it's not about making oneself better, but our basic vows are to help others. So I think, you know, how we reconcile those two things is a constant theme in practice. So there isn't, it's not that there's something, I wouldn't say that there's something wrong with wanting to be a better person or that one shouldn't have that. And in fact, probably most of us wouldn't be here if we didn't have that kind of impulse. And yet, then how do we fit that together with basic Buddhist understanding? So the Bodhisattva vow is, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. It isn't, I'm a bad person, I vow to become better. You know, or I'm lacking, or there's something wrong with me and I should fix it. I haven't actually heard that in Buddhist teaching. So how do we fit those things together? And I'm going to read a little passage from Suzuki Roshi where he says, to live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being, moment after moment. So I think the small being is this voice that's always having some problem with things aren't quite good enough or not quite the way they're supposed to be. To live in the realm of Buddha nature means to die as a small being, moment after moment. When we lose our balance, we die, but at the same time, we also develop ourselves, we grow. Whatever we see is changing, losing its balance. The reason everything looks beautiful is because it is out of balance, but its background is always in perfect harmony. This is how everything exists in the realm of Buddha nature. Losing its balance against a background of perfect balance. So if you see things without realizing the background of Buddha nature, everything appears to be in the form of suffering. I keep having this image lately of having some difficulty and seeing that I have the concept of kind of zooming out. You know, like if maybe I've been using Google Earth too much, where you can zoom out. You know, so you can really go in close and look at something in detail. And then when you see that detail, of course, you don't, you know, it's wonderful. You can see all the little, actually I did that to find out where Gaia House was. You know, you can see the little buildings and sometimes the trees and so forth, but you don't know where it is. You know, what is it in relationship to anything else? But then you can zoom out and see, oh yeah, that's, you know, it's in this particular country, and then there's an ocean over there, and it all kind of works and is in relation to the rest of the universe. So I think our suffering often has to do with being in too close and thinking that that's the only thing that's happening. So in my own life, my father died a few months ago, and probably most of you or many of you have experienced the death of a parent or someone who's close to you. And if you're really up close to that, it can be pretty painful and hard to remember, you know, how do you zoom out? How do you see that life and death in the context of constant change, that everything comes into being and passes away? But I think when you zoom out and you see life and death as part of that background, so Suzuki Roshi says, the background is always in perfect harmony. There is life and death. Everyone who comes into being is going to pass away. So to be able to zoom out and see that, then everything exists the way that it needs to exist in the background of perfect harmony. Suzuki Roshi says, if you understand the background of existence, you realize that suffering itself is how we live and how we extend our life. So in Zen, we sometimes we emphasize the imbalance or disorder of life. So how to see that the background is in perfect harmony, I think, is how is the function of ritual, it's the function of ceremony in our life. So I've been thinking about our oryoki meals and the difference between having a meal where you can fix everything just as you like it and a meal as a ceremony. You know, what's the difference between those events? So the difference between having a bowl of porridge and making it work just how you want it, that's kind of like how we usually live our life. We're trying to fix things, so we run into some difficulty and we try to make it better. So if it's too cold, we try to make it hot. If it's too hot, we try to cool down. In the early days of our monastery, Tassajara, the stories I've heard are that people wanted to put sugar on their cereal in the morning, and then someone else didn't want sugar, but they wanted honey. And then, so honey was provided. And then some other people thought, well, actually molasses would really be tasty. And then there's milk. You have to have a little milk because it's too dry. And then some other people would want skim milk. And then some other people like soy milk because they can't have, or don't like cow's milk. And then, let's see, I'm not sure what other possibilities there. Anyway, it keeps going on like that. And finally, Suzuki Roshi said, we're going to serve gamasho, sesame salt, and that's it. And just taste the cereal as it is without trying to make it into your personal preference. So there's different kinds of suffering. There's the suffering of not having exactly what you want, and then there's the suffering of spending your life trying to avoid not having what you want. Right. So in order to have the porridge just right, there's quite a lot of effort and busyness that goes into making that happening. So an oryoki meal is the opportunity to zoom out, so to speak. So rather than getting up in there close and really working with the situation and fixing it up, it's a kind of zooming out and just, okay, I can see now how it relates to everything else and enjoy it in that way. There's a famous story that's told in the early suttas about a woman by the name of Kisa Gotami, who maybe some of you have heard this story. This was a very kind of tragic story of a woman who had lost her only child. Her baby had died, and she basically was mad with grief and was carrying the baby around in her arms, going from one person to another. And in her derangement, her grief was so intense that she was somewhat deranged and didn't even accept that the baby was dead. She thought that the child was in some way, this child was still alive, and she was desperately seeking medicine, seeking some cure for her baby. And she finally came to the Buddha and asked the Buddha for some medicine to cure the baby. And the Buddha said, yes, I can help you. And in order to make this medicine, I need a mustard seed. I need some mustard seeds and the mustard seed must be a pure mustard seed. So please find some mustard seeds from a household where no one has died. So Kisa Gotami set off in the village to find a mustard seed, and she went from house to house asking, do you have a mustard seed? Is this a house where no one has died, where your parents or children, where no one has died, do you have a pure mustard seed? And of course, no one could give her such a thing. Everyone had experienced death. There wasn't a mustard seed to be found in this way. And as she did this, she came to understand that she was part of the family of human beings, that her situation was completely in accord with the way we live our lives. So this was a kind of, for her, a kind of zooming out to see the whole picture. And as she did that, she understood that, in fact, her baby had died. And so through doing this practice, so the Buddha had given her this practice. Rather than telling her, if he had just told her, well, actually, your baby is dead and there's nothing that can be done, she wouldn't have been able to hear it. But through doing this practice, she came to see how she related to everyone else and to the universe, and on her own to come to a kind of distance from the situation that she was able to live with. So I think that this is kind of how our practices work, that just by fitting ourselves into the rhythm of acting together, kind of acting as one body, we see our relationship to the universe, we see our relationship to as Suzuki Roshi says, the background of Buddha nature. So this background is always in perfect harmony, but it's difficult to see it. So how do we see it? We have to find some way of living our life so that we can actually see this background of Buddha nature. So I think any kind of practice or ceremony or ritual that expresses our intention as a bodhisattva to help others might be seen as a ritual or a ceremony. So not ceremony action is not done in order to achieve something, to accomplish some end. And as we do a ceremony, I think we can keep seeing in ourselves that tendency that there's always that wanting to grab onto it in some way, or wanting to do it right. And of course, everyone has their own relationship to ceremonies, either wanting to do it right or wanting to get away from it, not caring about it. So you may notice that in yourself as you do these forms, bowing and so forth. Are you grabbing on? Are you trying to be the best? Are you doing it properly or what you think is proper? Or are you wishing that it was all over? Are you wanting to get away from it? So either of those reactions is, let's say, it's not necessary to have a judgment about that. I wouldn't say that one is better than another, but the form itself gives the opportunity to see how your mind is working, what it's doing at that moment. So I think probably all religions have some ceremonial forms that help human beings deal with particularly transitional times of life, like funerals and weddings, changes that we go through. And maybe Zen is unique, and that we pick up any kind of action, anything that we do can be a dharma gate, as we say, an entry for understanding. And such as going to bed or brushing the teeth, as I mentioned yesterday. So not just major life events like a wedding or a major commitment, but any daily activity is something that we can really pay attention to. And I wanted to read a little from the Avatamsaka Sutra. The Avatamsaka or Flower Ornament Sutra. So this is from a chapter called Purifying Practice. And each chapter in this sutra has a different bodhisattva or enlightening being. And in this chapter, the enlightening being chief in knowledge is questioning Manjushri. And the question is, how can enlightening beings, or how can a bodhisattva attain faultless physical, verbal, and mental action? How can they attain harmless physical, verbal, and mental action? How can they attain blameless physical, verbal, and mental action? In other words, how do we live our life? How do we live our life in terms of body, speech, and mind? How do we attain unshakable physical, verbal, and mental action? How to attain excellent and pure action? And how can they cultivate well the branches of enlightenment? How can they fulfill kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity? And Manjushri replies, excellent child of Buddha, you have asked this out of a desire to benefit many, to bring peace to many, out of pity for the world, to profit and gladden celestial and human beings. If enlightening beings use their minds properly, they can attain all supreme qualities, can have a mind unhindered in regard to all enlightening teachings, can remain on the path of the Buddhas of past, present, and future. And then he goes on to say how this is done. And it's done through any action, so any action of body, speech, and mind, to have in mind awareness of that action. And so there are a number of verses here, and this is really the origin of the verses that many of you are familiar with, such as verses for washing the face, brushing the teeth, bathing, and so forth. So enlightening beings at home should wish that all beings realize the nature of home is empty and escape its pressures. While serving their parents, they should wish that all beings serve the Buddha, protecting and nourishing everyone. So I'm not going to read all of these. It goes on and on and on, but just some more that really kind of stood out for me. When brushing the teeth, actually he says when chewing on the tooth stick, but I think we could say when brushing the teeth, one should wish that all beings be harmonious and pure in mind, biting through all afflictions. When going to the toilet, they should wish that all beings reject greed, hate, and folly, and clean away sinful things. When washing the hands with water, they should wish that all beings have pure, clean hands to receive and hold Buddhist teachings. When washing the face with water, they should wish that all beings attain the pure teaching and be forever free from defilement. Seeing a road downhill, they should wish that all beings be humble in mind and develop enlightened bases of virtue. Seeing a dusty road, they should wish that all beings get rid of dust and dirt and attain the state of purity. Seeing a dust-free road, they should wish that all beings always practice great compassion, their hearts refreshing and nourishing. In other words, any time during the day, anything that you do, entering a room, leaving a room, taking your seat, you can arouse compassion for all beings and the wish that all beings attain great understanding. So it's not we don't have the sense that some actions are pure and others aren't, or that some actions are sacred and other actions aren't. But how can we practice at all times? And so I think particularly with meals, it's an opportunity to really pay attention, opening the bowls, receiving your food, eating your food, cleaning the bowl, putting the bowl away. How can you do each of these actions with full mindfulness? That's really our effort, to see these actions against, you know, so to pay attention to the minute action of what you're doing, and at the same time seeing it against the background of Buddha nature, seeing it in the background of the whole universe as eating. So as I chew this mouthful of food, the entire universe is taking nourishment, and I see myself in relation to that. So I think this might be a good time to bring up your questions or your feelings about how these practices have been for you so far, and how you see it as fitting into your Buddhist practice. Any comments or questions?
Yes.
Well, I've come to feel that they're very important for me, and that's part of the reason that I'm at this retreat, and part of the reason why I go to day retreats. But I also notice within myself this kind of despair, because with, for instance, the ceremonies and the rituals, there are two parts to what I'm feeling. Because of my background, I feel I want it done with dignity and grace and presence. And I feel that I just don't get enough practice. And whilst this is a great opportunity, and I'm really pleased that you're here and that we're doing this retreat in the way that we are, there is still this kind of feeling, I can't get this ritual and ceremonial part quite right, because we don't have a monastery, and I'm not here often enough, and Maya will go away and Red will come, and you know, there's 6 months in between and all the rest of it. And I recognize that I could bring a lot of what you're saying to my life outside, and I tried. But I feel that the two are linked in some way in my mind, and it's very difficult for me to feel kind of confident and joyful about the whole process. Sorry, it's a long...
Yeah, well, a number of things that you said I really appreciate. So this idea of acting with dignity and grace, and there was one more thing.
Presence.
Yeah, so I think that's maybe the question, is how do we carry on our life? You know, so our actions of body, speech, and mind are expressions of dignity, grace, and presence. And how do we act in a way that we that we even remember that that's what we want to do and to express that. So ultimately, it's not a question of doing the form properly, really. And that's, you know, a lot of these forms are arbitrary, or there's an arbitrary aspect to them. In the by arbitrary, I mean they're maybe tailored to a particular situation. They work. I'm not sure that's the word that I want, but they're provisional. So it's not that they're correct. It's just that you have to do something. You know, just like you have to use, unless you're going to hop into the room, you're going to use one foot rather than the other. So it's not that the left foot is correct. It's just that's the one that we've agreed on. So the forms are helpful, but then if you think, oh, that's the right one, and anyone who doesn't do it is morally improper, you know, that's a delusion, you know, that you're just causing more suffering for yourself. So the whole point is simply to be upright, to live your life in an upright way. And these forms can help to do that, but a lot of the time you're not going to have a particular rule about whether to use your right or left foot. Right? Just in your life, things are being thrown at you constantly, and you respond. And how do you remain upright in that situation? And so, to some extent, doing these forms is a kind of training of learning not the form, but learning how to come back to your body, how to come back to where you are. That's what I think you want to take away from it, that, you know, that training, like I also practice tea, Japanese tea ceremony, and I remember once my tea teacher, tea training is very, very for me, it's been the same kind of training as training in Zendo forms, and sometimes even more so. And my tea teacher saying once, I was standing on a kind of a lintel, not sure the word, that separated in a doorway, and it's like, he was like, don't put your foot on that. And it was like, okay. It's like, and basically what she was saying was, just stand upright. You know, like, don't lean against the wall. You know, when you lean against the wall, you're like, where are you? You're not fully embodied. It's, you know, to slouch is... It's not that slouching is bad. The problem with slouching is that you're not fully aware of where your body is. Now, you may say, well, I'm slouching for these reasons, and okay, fine. You know, maybe you need to do that. But it might be that you've, even for a second, that you've lost yourself. So just to keep coming back to an upright position in order to have your mind lined up as well. I think that's the training. To use these forms as a way of realigning over and over again. So I think, yeah, obviously, you know, forms, you know, monastic forms are developed in the context of people who are doing them daily and are trained over a period of time. So So I've been working with some of you on the bells and the makugyo, the little drum for morning service, and some of you may have noticed that, I don't know, if maybe you haven't noticed, sometimes the bells hit in the wrong place or it's the wrong bell or whatever, but that's, you know, to train in doing that can take months or years of training every day, you know, in a situation where that's what you're always doing. And if you're not doing it every day, then it's not going to come out the same way. But it's the attention that's important, you know, not whether it comes out perfectly. In fact, my own feeling is, you know, having spent a little bit of time in Japanese monasteries, that it's possible to put too much emphasis on the forms, and you get into a situation where you're doing them absolutely perfectly, but what's the point? You know, you maybe it's become rigid, and you've forgotten the vow behind it. It's just become a question of doing the best form. So I think it's the intention and vow behind what you're doing that's really important, not whether you get the right bell at the right time or that kind of thing. Bernadette, did you have
in giving Michael the answer, but I'll ask you just the same. At the beginning, you made a difference between whether it's a question of leaning, whether we want to do our best or we don't want to get so involved in our practice, whether we want to be the best or resisting not doing so well. But I find that I don't have, not so, what about when you just want to do your best? You don't try to be the best, you're not guilty of not wanting to do it, but it's still, just wanting to do your best can cause you some anxiety.
I think I would try to, I would make a difference between making your best effort and accomplishing the best.
Okay. Yeah.
So just make your best effort moment after moment and give it away. Mm-hmm. So the anxiety is around, did I get it?
The result.
Yeah. And yeah, probably everyone has that experience. So that's the, you know, like being zoomed in so close that you're not, that you're just, you're looking at that, it's kind of, and it's imaginary, right? It's a fantasy, because there isn't such a thing as, okay, now I got it. Now I have the perfect gassho, and what you mean to frame it or take a picture of it and hang it up on the wall or make sure that everybody sees it and remembers that Bernadette had, you know, she got it. And that's been accomplished and preserved for, you know, it's, you know, but yet we can see how silly that is, and at the same time we keep coming back to it and imagining that there is that possibility that we can do it. So just over and over again, we do it and drop it and throw it away. And that's, I think, part of the beauty of doing these forms is that you can see that process happening over and over. You know, if because we do that in our life anyway, but it's not necessarily so obvious. But when we have these forms to practice with, then you can actually be more aware of that happening. So that's just something to study, to look at, to see how that works, how that keeps coming up, how you want to do it right, and then grab hold of that and preserve it. Yeah, Melvin.
I'm just wondering when one goes to a retreat and you practice sitting, and then you go home and there's an intention to carry on sitting, and some teachers recommend that you try and sit once or twice a day, but not worry about whether you do or not, but just have that intention to try and do that. And I'm just wondering whether you would feel that such a thing might be worthwhile with Oyoki, to try and just at home for oneself to try and be with that intention of using the form.
You wonder whether it would be good to have an Oryoki meal at home by yourself?
Yeah, but just the form, you know, the form of opening the bowls and having separate dishes in each bowl, and just being mindful of the whole ceremony ritual of Oryoki. And you feel that's sort of possible and upright, worthwhile thing to try and do?
Well, I have to think about it. I confess I don't think it's really occurred to me before to do it in exactly that way, because I think of Oryoki as a communal practice. Because, you know, part of it is the giving and receiving of food, and it's really designed as a communal practice. And but there may be some elements of it that you could do. I guess I'm hesitant to, and I think, you know, each person has to figure it out for themselves, but it can be to set something up for yourself that you can't sustain. I think may not feel so good. So to really think about what you can do, like maybe it might be once a week, or, I mean, there are things that you can do in a retreat or a sesshin that if you then try to do every day, eventually isn't actually going to work. And then in the end, you may just stop altogether. So I think it's good to really think about what is sustainable. And it might be that even just before eating, to recite a verse and offer your food. You know, that might be enough. You know, and for some people, just that, just even to for example, the practice of sitting down to eat can be an extremely difficult practice to do at home. So to not pop something into your mouth while you're walking around, or to not drink while you're walking around. So this seems really simple, right? You're talking about doing a whole Oryoki practice at home. How about just sitting down when you eat? To try taking that practice up. I've heard many people say they can barely do that at home, that would be like a major change in their whole life. To just break that habit of picking something up and sticking it in your mouth, even to insert 5 seconds in there, just long enough to sit down and be aware of what you're doing. So you might start with that. I mean, maybe you're already doing that, but and then if you want to do Oryoki, try it. But it might be difficult to do it every.
Yeah, I was thinking of aspects of it. Because obviously you can't do the sharing of certain things. But whether there was, and I think the sitting down for me actually. I mean, there's bits of what I'm doing, but I do sort of pick something up as I'm walking along and eat it. So
maybe just try that. And so sitting down, and also just taking a second to offer the food to Buddha, to the universe. Just offer the food before eating it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Wendy.
I'm quite resistant, I notice, to learning new things. I quite like things to be easy.
Does anyone else feel that way? Is Wendy the only one?
And it's been, therefore, has highlighted. I have these difficulties. I'm going to a painting class. I have the same difficulties there as I do in Oryoki when she tries to teach me something. Say she's teaching me Goethe's thick color theory, but you're teaching me Oryoki thing. Oh, it really ruffles my feathers. Especially as she's changed from complete freedom to bringing in this theory. And I can, it's to do with me. Me comes up very strongly. And so I am drawn, or my attention is drawn to me, which I can, anything, free expression, I can gloss over. So it puts full attention on my kind of requirement that shall be recognized. Now, it's a kind of a requirement, it sounds dreadful. And she did say to me, I want you now to be objective. And in a sense, it's because it draws my attention to my resistance to anything new. And to having to put the energy, and I'm impatient, so it draws attention to the patience that I'm required to learn, to do this simple learning, my attachment very much to, either not being as good as somebody else or wanting to be. So it's quite, I find it really exhausting. I am quite exhausted. But I now, as I've more or less gone with it, I get bonuses in that I can feel much easier part of the group. Say when we're walking, I'm much more aware than I have been before of we're doing it, like you said, we're doing it at the same space. And I'm rather more accepting, actually, to be in that group situation. And I used to be a bit, people didn't go fast, but but now I found that it was the familiar things were enhanced. I accepted the process and found that more delightful in a way, more. I could let go a bit more of myself there for the group walking. It's had an effect on the sitting too, because I don't strive so. I can't. So tired. I thought I'm so tired now. I'm exhausted. I just have to just relax in this sitting. So in a funny way, it has had. Bonuses.
It has.
Bonuses, or made me see, because I was so tired, I just had to relax. You know, I couldn't find any more.
Yeah, so you've brought about, I think, a number of important points. So
yes.
The forms. When that resistance comes up of you don't want to do it that way, then that's a really wonderful opportunity to see that sense of self popping up of this is who I am, as if my being depends on being able to do it this way, right? So this is how we study the self, how we find our that somewhere in there we have some belief that I exist, you know, independently and mm-hmm. indefinitely, if not eternally. Mm-hmm. And so you can study and understand in some way that's actually not true, but then there it is. You know, it keeps popping up. So that's the gift that your painting teacher is giving you is being able to see that keep popping up over and over. And as we practice together as a group, it's also the opportunity to take up the intention of acting for the benefit of others, of moving maybe not necessarily at exactly the pace that you want to move, but doing it as part of the group body. So we're kind of moving as a group, eating together, walking together. If you walk too fast, you're going to bump into someone. If you go too slowly, the person behind you will stumble into you. So how to give up your own inclinations and think about, well, what's actually going to work for this, for the group? That kind of maybe goes against some of our ideas about what it is to be free. You know, I can do what I want, that kind of idea. So, you know, really, what is it to be free? I mean, because we've all tried that already, right? Mm-hmm. We've all tried doing what we want, and it didn't work so well, or you wouldn't be here, is my guess. It actually doesn't work to find freedom in that way. Yes?
I'll probably struggle with putting this into words. I find language quite difficult when you treat it. I found your quotes from Suzuki Roshi very helpful. And I notice what a lot of my sitting practice seems concerned with broadly is very similar to what I feel I'm concerned with in my larger counter life living. And it seems to be something to do with the perceived, or the paradox, as you put it, between the cultivation aspect of practice, the intentional bringing into being aspect, both of full practice and of acting in the world, and the practice which is about realizing that things are perfect as they are. And my mind seems to oscillate between the two. It feels quite hard to sense the connection between how they sort of interlock, if you like. And so I feel often in my sitting practice I'm noticing as it is, again and again. And then thoughts come up about, is this really all it should be? You know, and then I compare with the thoughts that compare with the personal practice, and I think, but there's, you know, maybe I really should be cultivating more matter. And it goes like that. Similarly, with the outer practice in the world, is my practice of saving all beings, doing what I can to enable all beings to recognize it as it is, in its perfection, or is my practice to help beings suffer less through trying to cultivate a different world, a world that maybe isn't going to be culminating something rather terrible, you know, the effects of climate change and all that. So it's something to do with the how much is the realizing it's perfect as it is, partly so that you can understand how conditionality works, so that you can stop doing it that way and cultivate something different. I think it's that. I can't. I seem to spend years with this back and forth.
Well, I think to some extent it's the similar question to what Bernadette brought up earlier about the effort and the results. So to the extent that, yes, you do want to help others and to make the world a better place and so forth, and to be attached to the results is exhausting, because you can never do enough. There's always going to be another difficulty or another problem or another, there isn't going to be an end. So to the extent that we are trying to make things a certain way, we tend to get worn out, to get exhausted. So to just keep coming back to an upright effort, so that you're not leaning over to one side or another, so you're not slouching back and you're not grabbing on, but you're actually fully exerting yourself. But you're upright, so you're not being exhausted. So each moment you're doing your best and really completely expressing yourself in each moment and letting go of it without concern. To be able to notice that, you know, and to see, and when you start feeling that exhaustion, to notice that you need to come back a little.
Zoom out.
Yeah. That you're up a little too close, that you're not seeing the background.
Okay. I wonder if you might talk a little bit about practice discussions for those who are new to the retreat planning things, the Zen retreat, what that involves, and for some people might not be that into the
You'd like me to explain the interview form?
Yeah, well, no, just about what you can, questions you can take up or what the point of it is. So
you're welcome to make an appointment and talk with me individually about any of these questions or how you about your practice during this retreat, particularly about your posture. So if you have questions about your sitting, about meditation, you're welcome to make an appointment and to talk. So my idea is to do it fairly informally. Doesn't have to have a particular form. So anything that you'd like to bring up is fine. Okay. Yes.
Can you comment a little bit on when it's okay to do absolutely nothing? The context for my question is, I found it very helpful to meditate on uprightness. And often find myself reaching a point in situations where I'm uncertain whether I'm upright or which way to lean. And often find it kind of quite helpful to be quite gentle with myself and just give myself a break. The most mundane form would just take a rest for a while, not particularly think about anything for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to comment on the, amongst this kind of active space of leaning, not leaning, uprightness, how one can practice moving in and out of this sort of gentleness and doing nothing state.
So you're wondering if it's okay or when it's appropriate to do nothing?
Yeah, because in some cases it feels to be absolutely the right thing to do nothing, and in other cases it's a sort of form of resistance. And I'm not, I don't think I'm talking about slowfulness. When to be active in this practice and when to be inactive, and how to navigate between those. Or is there a concept of being inactive?
Well, it's extremely difficult to do absolutely nothing. I'd say it's always okay to do absolutely nothing. So please do absolutely nothing. And then notice what it is that you're doing. And that may be enough. So, and then you may feel, well, that's too much. I can't. I just want to check out for a minute.
Check out of doing nothing.
I would say that it would be great. It'd be great to do absolutely nothing. Usually we're doing something. And so in Zazen is the opportunity to notice that creation of something, that we're always trying to create something. There's always some effort to create something. And in Zazen is the opportunity to relinquish that control. So generally we feel that, you know, we need to keep a grip on things, or I don't know, something terrible may happen, that I may vanish, you know, I may not exist if I don't keep myself going, if I don't keep producing myself moment after moment. So actually you don't need to produce yourself or create yourself or do something. It's actually okay to let go. So really, that's really what renunciation is, to renounce that effort to keep the self going. So it's okay to just let go and then notice that effort, or that how difficult it is to let go. And that's, you know, to follow the breath is kind of a provisional instruction. It's like, well, what am I going to do if I'm not doing something? Well, you could follow your breath. That might be helpful as some way of some place to put your attention. Just follow your breath. Don't do anything else. Just that. Does that make sense?
Could I just take something out, which I think is related to what Steve just said about, I notice when I come on retreat, I have a pattern of living in my daily life that I'm extremely busy. And so when I come to retreat and relax, I find that I want to go and rest a lot because I have this built-up fatigue. And that's where I perceive as a connection. Like sometimes I just feel like, oh, I just want to go and lie down and sleep. And how to do that in a skillful way, and when is it too much, or...
Right. Yeah. So, I don't have a particular rule for that, and that's also probably a question for everyone. So when do you want to push yourself, and when is it just you can't make that effort, that you really do need to sleep. Yeah. I think that's a question that, you know, really each person needs to answer. And everyone reaches a point, you know, there is a point where you just need to sleep. But you can experiment with that edge. And, you know, it may be different, maybe a different point than what you think it is. You know, there may be a kind of sleepy zazen, which is a different zazen than you've experienced before. And then, you know, but for everyone, there's going to be some point where, you know, you keel over. But I don't know what that point is. You know, I don't think we can say everyone's body is different. But please find that point of energy.
I just wanted to say that I find paying attention to what I'm doing to keep myself awake is really a good antidote for insomnia. I fall asleep if I'm paying attention to what's keeping me awake, if that makes sense. If I'm aware of the busyness, practicing zazen is good for me. I can fall asleep in zazen.
Okay, don't listen to Devon.
Presumably we're not allowed to keel over in the Zendo.
If you do keel over, we'll try to take care of you. Yeah, we'll. Yes?
I've been interested in this retreat as being quite different to other retreats because of the constraint of being rushed in the Oriyoki, being the pressure of time, it's the work task. And it puts me in a position of being much more mindful of everybody else. I'm feeling a bit anxious. I think it's useful, but it's quite different to what I've experienced on other retreats.
You're feeling some anxiety about eating, about the food?
About the eating, about hitting the deadlines, you know, about finishing at the right time so we can do, I can do the ringing the bell, which I didn't do today.
About finishing the meal on time? Do you feel like you're not having enough time to eat?
No. It's more making decisions about how quickly I eat or how much I take, because I'm aware of this. It's not even real, because I can't influence how we all going to complete this meal together. But I feel as if, you know, that I have some responsibility about.
You are responsible for the group.
Yes, that's what it is.
That's right. We're all responsible for each other. Yeah. Are other people feeling some anxiety around that also? Is there anyone who's not feeling anxiety? So I think as we as the form becomes more familiar, it, you know, it may be more comfortable, and and we all do need to pay attention to each other. So it really is a kind of group eating rather than just having your own pace for eating. But I think the pace at breakfast this morning was pretty good. I think that'll work. And the schedule in the morning is a little tight because of the overall Gaia House schedule. And we don't really have any wiggle room in there for breakfast. I think lunch and tea, there's a little more space. So if we don't finish right on the dot, it's not such a problem. I don't know if that addresses
it. The whole issue of the feeling of decision making being rushed and time constraints, which is, you know, that's my life. And it's not something that I've been familiar about arising on the retreat. So it's quite useful, because especially because we're in silence, we can't actually express, you know, how we're going to do this together. We are just dependent on all of us being in kind of harmony and mindful. And I do think that it's really useful. And I do think that I would echo what other people have said, that the Oyoko practice, my experience is that it's really strengthened this group, because it feels as if we are all in this together. And it's been a delight actually doing it at the beginning with everyone, because there isn't a sense of some people being really good, only being awkward and clumsy and getting it all wrong. It's like a whole group experience. I feel incredibly appreciative of the group and the view for having this.
Yeah, and there's really a kind of balance between moving right along but not rushing. You know, what's the edge there of doing things quite rapidly, just doing it. So to just do something, but to be present in each moment without rushing with each moment. So each mouthful of food, to not rush, but just mouthful after mouthful of food, completely eating.
This occurs to me from you saying that, I put my hand up and you ask if people were not feeling any anxiety. I want to say that I'm not feeling any more anxiety than usual. clarify that point, in conjunction to what you were just saying. Feels like it's bringing what you're just talking about, moving along, just doing it, but without rushing, feels a really useful thing for us all to learn in the kind of lives we lead today. Mm-hmm. Because we are living at a very fast pace, and I live at a lot slower pace than most people, it still feels very fast. And so that learning how to do that, to move along at a fast pace, without anxiety, would be quite helpful. Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it'd be a good time to end. May our intention equally extend to every vacant place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are exhaustible, I bow.